When I started, I was the only woman in Chicago that was doing sound design for theater, and I didn't know it. I was just doing it because I loved it, and people were hiring me, and I didn't really think too much of it until someone, I don't know, I was like 5 or 10 years in, said, "Well, don't you realize you're a pioneer for the rest of us?"
I could not be more excited about introducing you to an artist whose creative prowess knows no bounds. She's an acclaimed composer, musician, author, professor, and sculptor of theatrical sound, and it's all rolled into one magnificent force. I am truly privileged to have Victoria Toy Diario here today. Her visionary expertise in crafting musical mosaics for theater has shattered the boundaries of sound design for women. Whether it was the soul-stirring tones of A Christmas Carol at the St. Clemens or the unforgettable harmonies of The Bluest Eye at the Steppenwolf in Chicago, Toy has infused the very essence of enchantment into every production she touches. Join me in giving a resounding welcome to the inimitable Victoria Toy Diario. Toy, welcome to the show. Let's start at the beginning. Where does your story begin?
I started as a ballet dancer. I was on scholarship at Joffrey Ballet at age 14. I moved to Manhattan and practiced ballet there. I also did summers in Toronto with Canadian Ballet and also the New York City Ballet in Saratoga Performing Arts Center in the summers. And then when I was finishing high school and deciding if I was going to go into ballet, I decided not to. And I went and got a degree at Syracuse University in musical theater. I found at Syracuse that I really loved acting and directing. I studied abroad at RADA and Lambda and really fell in love with classical theater and came back and decided not to go back to New York. I had a lot of failure issues that came up with ballet with New York, and I was like, I'm not going to go back there to that city. And Chicago was so vibrant at that time at the end of the 80s, beginning of the 90s, with like really experimental, fun, risky storefront theaters. And it just, I came, visited, loved it, and was like, I'm going to move to Chicago. So I came to Chicago. I acted and directed for a little bit. And then I joined a rock and roll band. And I was playing guitar and singing and had my own band and produced 2 CDs of my own music. And then all of my friends in theater, I had helped found a theater company called Rivendell Theater Ensemble here in Chicago. It's one of the premier female-fronted and supporting theaters in Chicago. And they asked me to do sound design while I was doing music. And I was like, sure, I think I can write the music for the play and put some wind in, you know. So I ended up doing that. And then from that point forward, that just took off. And I was also a massage therapist at that point. And all that other stuff had to kind of go away because sound design took over. And then DePaul University was looking for someone to build a sound program for a BFA program. So I interviewed with no teaching experience whatsoever, and they hired me based on experience. And I'm so grateful for that. And for the past 15 years, I had run that program and have brought other designers out into the world.
All right, we have to go back. You said you had a CD. You were in a rock band.
Yes.
What were the name of the CD? What was the name of the band?
Okay, so the first band was called The Knolls. That CD was Hello Cleveland. And then my band was called Toy Band. And I had 2 CDs. One was called Ever Endeavor, like Endeavor, ENDEAVOR. And the other one was Slowly But Surely, which was a little bit more of a solo acoustic kind of stuff.
I
So,
love it.
yeah.
Love it. Tell me, like one of the things I think that so many times we hear students talk about is almost that fear. Something not just sort of the fear of failure so much of like, how will I love music, I love the technology, I love bringing the audio experience to people in different mediums. I don't know how to get there. Right. It sounds like in that journey, you had a couple of survival jobs.
while you were kind of learning to like, or at least finding the path to sound design. Talk to me a little bit about that time of juggling, what would be massage therapy, which sounds like, you know what, it probably has come in useful throughout your
Yes, very.
life.
Yep.
But I'd love to hear a little bit more about that.
Sure. I think, that's the that is the point of which most people would think is the scariest. I don't really have that fear gene. I would just kind of do things if it made me happy and content, and if I didn't, I would change tack. That was basically how I would judge my life. Like how I lived my actual day was going to be how I lived my life. I didn't want to have that day be something that I was not happy doing. So that's basically how I kept switching in my life and doing so many different things. I also think that I don't like being bored, and I like doing a lot of different things, which theater really affords because every story is different, every group of people is different. It's kind of amazing that way. But getting back to the idea of freelancing and having survival jobs, as long as I knew I had money coming in that I could have a roof over my head and food in my fridge, I felt like I was doing good. And I took a lot of shows at a lot of, and I work overworked myself in my youth because that's what that time period made us do at that time in order for us to succeed. I didn't have much of a life, work life balance in any way in my youth. I also think that maybe that's what youth is for, that as you get wiser, you learn how to do that better. I don't know. I think following your passion and what you love to do is really the key to it all. And trying to make those opportunities, I think, is the hardest part of it. And everybody always asks me that, even all of my students too. And I think it's really about meeting people, and a lot of it is luck, unfortunately. But if you're in the right place at the right time, so can you get yourself in the right place at the right time is really kind of the key in who to meet and who to befriend, who to take on as your mentors. Where do you want to go? What do you want to learn? What city do you want to live in? Try it out. See that it's more about life in something that's artistic and trying to find a path of that. It's really it has to be incorporated into your life. It's not like a job that you would just go, well, I'm going to just go here, interview, get the job, and then I'm going to work from this hour to that hour. It's not really about that. It's about the relationships that you build along the way and how that benefits you into your art and your art form of what you do.
Oh, that's fantastic. And I think that's great advice. As someone who is in an adjacent, I call it where art meets technology, and becomes design is intentional, right? I love a part of the story that you start out in ballet, right? That your trajectory wasn't this straight line to sound design. It felt like maybe almost moments of discovery within yourself and within the art and maybe the business of what you did. Can you tell me a little bit about kind of like that phase of going from or having an opportunity in front of you? Maybe you've never done before. It sounded as sound design and theater, like live theater. First of all, it like gives me palpitations because it's live. So,
But
there's like an orchestra, totally. And there's an orchestration to it, I would
that.
imagine.
Yeah, of course. Okay, so this it's funny that the journey seems like it's kind of all over the place, but when I look back at it and I starting in ballet, which is an expression of music and sound on stage through the body, I am doing the mirror image of that, where I see something on stage that is moving on stage in space, and I'm supplying the music and the expression of what I feel is what they are expressing. So I am actually doing the opposite in a sense of that first ballet part of it. The acting and the directing side of it, all of that really helps, and the performing, even in music, really, really helps me in understanding the journey of the actors on stage. For me to be able to support them and not leave them all on their own in order to come up with all of this emotional thing. I actually help them with that support of having music underneath them. So that aids in that telling that story. And the teaching, surprisingly, has evolved my skill set, because having to slow down, figure out how I do things, and then teach it to others has made me change how I do things and how I approach things and how I work. So it feels like every step of it was made to be an amalgamation into what this is. And I'm yet adding my next stage, which I got certified in sound therapy. So I am adding back in the massage therapy side and the holistic health side back in with sound, of how sound and frequency hit the human body, and moving into that as well, into holistic health. So I feel like every little step has taught me something, has enriched my life. I have applied it as I went. So none of it felt like, oh, this was just the job for money, or this was just the job for this. Like, I feel like every step has been something that has added to my life journey that I will look back on and go, oh, that's why that happened.
You know, one of the things that I was reading about some of your work is that you're kind of early in the space of biophilic sound. Talk to our listeners about, like, let's start with, what is biophilic sound?
I wish I knew more than I know about it. So I think it's something that's that is still, for me, it's part of what's being explored, but it has not been fully explained in a sense. But I was asked to do a few speaking engagements for architects about what it's like to hear sound in different spaces. So biophilic sound is about bringing the outside, the nature, the biosphere of what we live on the planet indoors, instead of having these box rooms. So architects are looking at biophilic design as far as, you know, does the indoors have, how much greenery does it have, how much light does it have? And they were not, at the time that I had done the speaking engagements, they had not really thought about the sense of hearing. They were really thinking about sight and touch and but not really sound. So I came in and did a whole explanation, and had them, the first one I did, I had them all blindfolded and just did all of these different things of different, like, thunderstorms. And I tried to stay very natural with it. And by the end of it, I had so many really deep conversations about how human beings react to the sounds in the world around them, how much of that would be productive or not productive in a workspace, what is distracting, what is not distracting, is something that is bouncing or reverberating, what's the difference of that in a space, and do they feel lost, do they feel intimate, do they feel safe, do they, you know, like, all of those kind of conversations. So I think that's something that that field is still going to continue on with. I'm not as a part of it as I had started in the beginning. Just who knows if it'll come back into my life, but it's really fascinating to have that group of people open up their ears, in a sense, as to what it's like to be in these buildings and these spaces that they built.
What are the experiences? I think it's an interesting place to dive into, particularly with the art of bringing in what will make you more productive, what will be more psychologically safe to bring out that sense of creativity, or to that. I even ponder as we think about the space of education and the physical spaces of education, with so many different organizations bringing things like kindergartners back to nature. It's like that. Where does sound design potentially have the potential to play in uniting, you know, children's minds with nature, or the, you know, the average worker's mind with something maybe that they enjoyed about working at home?
It's interesting, because hearing is not one-to-one. We have selective hearing, so we don't hear everything in the world at once, or else we would go mad if we did that. It's funny, because I was actually having this conversation about somebody with the ocular implants, that when they put those in, you do hear one-to-one. And sometimes the deaf that have had those put in have to take them out at night because it's too overwhelming. And I, you know, I think about the idea of, like, you don't have the ability to selectively hear, which is very interesting to me. But selective hearing of like what the neural pathways of the brain that have happened with that sound, that you know, it's not necessary for you to know that because sound is really a survival tool in a sense, that in the evolutionary response to it, not the associational response. Associational response is more emotional, but the evolutionary response is really a survival tool. And we just stop listening. We stop listening to the hum of the fluorescence. We stop listening to the cars in the road. We stop listening to like all that stuff we don't really need. So when you purposefully, selectively put sound in to a space, you're creating that selective hearing so that you know that if you want them to hear it again, you would change the amplitude or change the frequency and the brain would clue in again. And then it'll slowly, selectively not hear it if it doesn't need to. So you could use those tools in effect to possibly change things around and make it a different environment. You know, it's
Absolutely.
fascinating, actually. You know, you're talking about our workspaces, that there was a study done during wartime in World War II where they started putting music into the warehouses where the women were working while the men were at war. And they found that productivity went up 25% if they had music in there.
I think
So,
that's phenomenal. I mean, that's a phenomenal insight at a time when I think that we are figuring out what the future of everything is, the future of like space. What does ambient mean? You know, it's like we have all these technological devices around us. Put aside, like, are they physically good or is there psychological, but are there ways to make them better? All right. And not just for entertainment's sake, although that's a lot of fun. We don't mind being, I think the brain enjoys the entertainment and the storytelling. But, you know, when you extend it into the workplace or even how we learn, to give you a perspective, you know, I am dyslexic. I didn't learn to read till I was three. I learned through audiobooks, right? It was generally read along, or particularly the strain of memorization, things like that, mathematics, right? For me, I had to put things to song in order to commit them to memory. Talk to me a little bit about that in the spaces that maybe you have spent in around more inclusive design of how to bring us, no matter what age we are, whether you're early learning or I've even, you know, I've worked with folks that are working in the field of Alzheimer's, right? And the experiments going on at 40 megahertz are really just mind-blowing, but at the same time going, whoa, this is how sound design might be able to be brought to bear to help us be more resilient humans.
That is really the thing that's making me really excited right now, especially with the sound therapy and integral sound healing. It all comes down to intention, remarkably. Because I think of the selective hearing of sound, it has to be intentionally put in the space in order to have the effect that it needs to affect. It has to have the intention of why you're doing it to have that effect. So just for an example, with Alzheimer's or any kind of neural or cognitive issues, when you have two tones in both your ears, because it has to deal with the left and right hemisphere of the brain, if you have two different tones, the brain will entrain to the tone that's in between, or the frequency in between those two notes, perfectly in between them. By doing that, the right hemisphere speaks to the left hemisphere of the brain, and they're finding that that is creating cognitive thought, or a better cognitive thought. So that is just physical alone. The associational response of what happens to our body of like, when you have certain rhythms that will entrain your heart rate to lower, or will make your brain waves go into a theta state, which is the same state as when you're deeply asleep when your body is healing. The reason why we sleep is to heal overnight. That's why you should get 8 hours of sleep if you can, so you can get down into that theta wave state. But if you can get your brain waves to be in that theta wave state through frequency of sound, it will do the exact same thing. So there are different ways you can actually help the body do that. And that's just the actual physical reaction of the body. That's not even the emotional response of the psychological or psychiatric, probably applications that could happen as well, of like what puts you in a good mood, what doesn't, what things are consonant, which is dissonant, and how do those affect the basically the energy that we, which is our energetic the electricity in our body that runs our heart, that runs our pituitary system, that runs our endocrine glands, like all of those things are run by this energy that we have. So how do you keep that energy going and flowing and that electricity firing when it's supposed to as well? So there's this, it's so depth, there's so much depth in so many different areas where sound is concerned that it kind of blows my mind that it feels magical. Like I used to think that sound, like the actual delivery of sound was magic, because if you spoke into a diaphragm microphone and picked up those frequencies and the range of frequencies, and it goes across an AC cable that is basically an on-off switch of a cable into something else that then produces that diaphragm response into the other speaker, it'll come out exactly the same. And that to me was magic, you know, that I'm just like, oh my gosh. So breaking that down into what are these frequencies and how do they actually travel and how can we then, you know, use that with intention to be better.
I think that's just brilliant. And I think that the future holds so much possibility in this space. I think
I
often
agree.
we're only just, I think we're just at the beginning of a renaissance of sound, to be honest with you.
I do too. I feel it too.
My question is at the renaissance of sound, when I go looking for the premier sound designers, what I don't see is a ton of women in this space. Let's dive into what keeps women from pursuing this as a career.
I'm not sure that it's the pursuit of it. I think it's the lasting in it more than pursuit. Because I would say in recruiting for my program at DePaul, I have had many women, very many young women come into the program, and a lot of many different identifying genders as well. I mean, it's not the interest in it is not male. The perception it's gonna be tricky for me to do gracefully. The perception of what I've have felt my through my career is that people believe that men are better at it. I don't know. That's just from my experiences. And I've had to prove them wrong. And then they're like, oh, you're actually pretty good at this. So they're always surprised, you know, that a woman would be good at it, or, you know, someone who's more feminine would be good at it. And it's interesting because I find that the feminine have a different approach to sound than the masculine. I don't mean that in gender of human beings. I mean that in application, in a sense, that there is that kind of what we have defined in the past as feminine, as nurturing and community and multitasking kind of feelings, that is different than a masculine, like I'm going to achieve this by doing this, 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 and connect this to this, and it'll make this happen, you know. And in sound, you have to have both. It's interesting because if you're weighed one side, you're gonna need help from another human being that's more the other side. And if you're weighing more towards the more technical or whatever, you're gonna need someone who's more artistic to help you with that. So if you can somehow get in the middle brain space of that masculine connectivity of what sound does, and the feminine of the emotional reaction of that intentional, you know, support of the arts. Like if you can mirror those together, it becomes this really interesting and really rich design. You know, going back to like, you know, why there are more men.
Well, or even I think one of the things that you touched on, I think is important, that men, there is a perception that men are better. And you know, that takes me to for you know, I have been a designer for 25 years. I see that in industrial design and software design, right? I think there is still, you know, I mean, I was a girl who coded, but when I tell people that, right, isn't, oh, you can do that. Oh, you're really good at that. It's see, like they
It's a
are
surprise.
ultimately surprised by it. And
Yeah.
I think you're absolutely right in the perception. What do you think has helped shape that perception?
Well, I think it, because the fields were dominated by men originally. And so that's the common collective history. So obviously that must have been the best. But that's not the case anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It's just simply not. And, yeah. but it's hard to when you have to prove it, you know, like you have to prove it over and over again. But
so in your experience, tell me a little bit about those times when you had to prove it. There was maybe something in that pathway, whether it was a theatrical show or piece where you had to, again, the proof of creativity is so subjective. There's, if we go, I've always found that I had to go to the scientific and explain why it was creative. I meant when you're explaining, you're not demonstrating, like they don't get it. Yeah. And that's not a really good way to convince people. How have you done it?
Well, you know, when I started, I was the only woman in Chicago that was doing sound design for theater. And I didn't know it. I was just doing it because I loved it. And you know, people were hiring me and I didn't really think too much of it until someone, I don't know, I was like 5 or 10 years in, said, well, don't you realize you're a pioneer for the rest of us? And I was like, what? Like I had no thought of that ever. And I still don't even like that title. I don't know. It just feels funny.
Oh, just own it, Toy. Own it.
There were other women that were before me that were on different coasts. They were just not in Chicago. So it's hard for me to do that. But you know, it was interesting. There were many times where I came across people that when I was up for awards, they were like, they would ask me for what? And like other men. And I was just like, well, don't you know that I've been doing this? Like, hey, you don't know that. All right. So I came up against people just not knowing that I was there and that I was working, and I was working a lot. But, you know, the people who knew me obviously knew I was working, but the people who that were my peers did not really know I was working. It's interesting because I had a really good friend of mine who at first was like, well, maybe you're not getting ahead because you're not meeting the right people, and like we're trying to figure out whatever, because mm-hmm. my path has been a very slow and steady path, which I don't mind at all. Quite mm-hmm. honestly, I never really wanted fame or fortune. I just wanted to create work and art and, you know, and stories I want to tell with the people I want to tell them with. And but he would say, well, maybe that's why you're not getting ahead. And then after like the whole Me Too movement and all that stuff happened, he came back to me and said, you know what, I think it was because you were a woman. And I was like, oh my god, like you finally see me, thank you. It felt struggling only when I saw others advance faster, and I had to be okay with that and just realize that that wasn't my path and that wasn't my life. And would I be okay with my life at a different speed and a different outcome? And once I accepted that, then it didn't matter anymore. So then I just, that's when I think I actually stopped censoring myself and stopped worrying and stuff. And I was like, okay, I'm just going to own who I am in this place. And that's it, you know?
Are you passionate about closing the gender gap in the world of technology and design? Introducing designedbyus.org, a game changer in the fight for equality. Did you know the percentage of women in tech roles today is lower than it was in the 80s? It's shocking, but true. Only 26% compared to the 35% back in 1984. Design by Us is on a mission to close the gender gap in tech and design, and they need your help. Their action learning apprenticeships empowers young, diverse students to pursue careers in technology and design. By making a donation to designbyus.org, you can be a part of this vital change. Your contributions will support apprenticeship, boot camp, and resources for aspiring women in these fields. Together, we can level the playing field and give young, diverse people the support they need to learn, work, and constantly grow. Don't wait. Visit designedbyus.org/donate and make a difference. Designed by Us, closing the gender gap in tech and design.
In your opinion, how do you think we could create a more inclusive path into music and sound design, or particularly in your case? When I look at your accomplishments, one of the things I love about it is the focus on the theater. Albeit it's, you've had, you know, many applications to it, but my goodness, the work that you have gotten to do in theater, which, you know, I am sitting 50 miles north of New York right now in our Aurora 21 studios. I love theater. You know, I raised our kids, you know, going to the Broadway, like their theater community is the Broadway theater community. But I think so often we see the actor, we, you know, maybe we hear the instrument, but the mixing and the sound, we don't necessarily, I don't think, always attribute to a part of the entertainment. Yeah. And so in a world where you cannot be what you cannot, that you cannot see, how do we create a more inclusive path into this profession?
Oh my gosh, that was a huge thing that came up when the Tony Awards took away the sound Tony in 2014. And I think there were 17 of us that got onto a phone call and were just like, what? Like, we were the collaborators. Like, you wouldn't hear them. you wouldn't, the emotional response would not be the same. So we were like, why don't they not think we're part of the collaboration that deserves an award? So that formed actually the Theatrical Sound Designers and Composers Association, which I had the honor to co-chair for the first 4 years and really helped with the foundational documents of all that stuff. And that's been an interesting turnaround in our field that where at before that it felt very proprietary, where if you had to seek out mentors or others that were willing to pass down information to you. And now it was like, no, let's all share what we have because it'll make us stronger. So that flip happened in that time of creating that organization. So I think that organization is really vital to the theatrical world of sound design. There are a lot of other groups that, I mean, I'm sure you know them all too, of that are forming for women in sound and women composers and women engineers too. And I'm sure they're broadening. I don't know them very well, but I'm sure they're broadening their gender identities as well. I have always in my recruitment been very cognizant of wanting to give the opportunity to those who are underrepresented. And that takes shape in not only gender, but race, but any kind of expression right. of identity that I have never really sought out those that were highly proficient. I sought out those that wanted to do the work, who wanted to be that artist, who were okay in a field that did so much of the emotional lift without being recognized for the work that you're doing. Like it's an interesting personality that goes into sound design because it could be someone who's not comfortable with people or it could be somebody who's completely comfortable with people. But it's always somebody who's okay if they don't get the total recognition of what they're doing because they know what they've done and their peers know what they've done and that's enough. So it's an interesting way to look at it. But I think going into the high school level, especially now that things have gotten more digital and tend to be more technical and therefore can fit into the STEM thing part yeah. of it and not yeah. STEAM or STEAMed, yeah. That can fit into the STEM thing that it's now getting into high schools a little bit more than it was when I first started my program at 15 years ago. It was impossible to find. It was really hard to find students that knew what sound design and theater was. Now it's a completely different animal. They actually know a lot about it and the internet and the web and, you know, the YouTube videos and whatever. So it's a much different world now. But the artistry of it, is the thing that I think that could be enhanced more at that level so that perhaps you wouldn't need to go to college. You could mm-hmm. just work, right? So I didn't go to college for sound design. I figured it out as I went along. I mean, sure, I probably burned bridges along the way because I didn't have that safety net of college to make my mistakes in. So there's, you know, the idea that if you are the type of person who can be a self-study and create your career out of self-study, is there a way to actually do that? If you don't have the possibility to go to college or go to a trade school or whatever, how do you then bring that in? So I think the high school level is one way. I think online opportunities too, of teaching online masterclasses, stuff like that, which I've been thinking about lately, of like, how do I gather my friends together and create masterclasses that then could be shown to any level of any student who wants to learn. So I think there are ways to
do it. I guess we're just going to have to get all of you on the new Design by Us platform, which is exactly that.
There you go.
You know, I think that one of the things we have to rethink is that exactly those master classes, and then how we compensate those, the professor, the teacher, you know, equally as the, to the benefit of the students getting them. I'm with you there. Because the accessibility piece of it, I think, is to your point, you know, how do we democratize the education? And even, I think the education's actually the easy part. The part that you just touched on, which was the, what it takes to bring out the artistry, right? I have often found it's, you know, the artistry, sometimes the best artistry is generally in group work, where you are challenging each other's art, right? Through art, through the actual creation of it.
Yeah, I think that human beings work best when in person with each other. You know, as convenient as these Zoom rooms are too, the in-person actually feeling what another person is feeling, which is why I still love live theater, that is valuable. So it's actually invaluable. Anyway, that is what helps with human understanding, and that kind of communication and collaborative response is part of what makes all of us learn more, in a sense, or learn quicker, perhaps, too. There is the actual system design that you need to at least understand if you're on the artistic side of it. Hopefully you are proficient of it in it as well, as far as how to deliver the sound to an audience. That is really important, because without that delivery, the artistry will fall flat. So you have to know where the audience's ears are, whether they're moving around in the space or whether they're stationary, or if they're on the, in the balcony, if they're down below, or if they're, you know, if it's just a square room in a black box. How does every seat in that house get the same delivery of sound that you would expect? Now, the expectation has changed a lot too through my time, is that in the beginning, nobody really knew what we did. They thought we were magicians, in a sense, because we were creating almost scenic elements, in a sense, of when we would bring in birds or crickets or whatever, thunderstorms or whatever, you know, or any kind of algorithm to make it seem like a cathedral or a cave, or, you know, any of that stuff that would heighten the reality of the actual space we were in, instead of a black box of a theater. When you can make those walls transparent or not, that is your, that's your system design of that, extending the suspension of disbelief, in a sense, for the audience. So you can do it through hearing, because it's 360. Hearing is 360, and it tells us so much information about the space that we are in. So if you want to place the audience in a specific environment, you can actually change that environment now through all of the digital algorithms to make that happen, according to what's reverberating and what's resonating or absorbing. So there's that side of it. So that's system design. But then there's the artistic design of intention, which is about how to, in a sense, in a good way, manipulate an audience's emotions. And I mean, we have learned that a lot through movies, and that has transferred over into theater as well, as far as the kind of emotional manipulation that can happen in theater, of when you want to scare somebody, when you want them to be happy, when you want them to be sad, when you want to be in consonant with it or dissonance with it. So there are different ways, like if you want to create comedy, if you don't want to create comedy, there's so many different ways of like how sound can actually help with that.
Well, tell me a little bit about maybe how that has impacted maybe the work that you did on The Bluest Eye with the Steppenwolf, or maybe even A Christmas Carol. I mean, obviously two very like diametrically different maybe soundscapes.
Oh my gosh, but both so intentionally manipulative. Both those shows you just mentioned. I don't know if you know The Bluest Eye, Toni Morrison's Bluest Eye.
Yes. I'll tell
So
you, I do know it as, you know, as the book. I think it's important for those of you listening today, please go out and get this book. It
such a
is
great.
such an amazing book, but I have never seen it done in theater.
Yeah. That was a beautiful experience. It was all but one of the designers were female. It was an entirely black cast. At that point, we didn't have a black designers. So the design tech field has kind of diversified itself through the years. But for a while there, it was challenging. And I, being female, was honored to be on many di kind of diverse shows because they were just like, well, we're just going to choose the woman instead of the man, to in order to help diversify the storytelling. So I ended up on a lot of shows that were not of my culture or understanding, and I had to do a lot of work to be authentic. So sound and music has to be authentic, or else it doesn't work. So when you're talking about a black family in the South in t different time periods of our history and what that's like, you have to do a lot of homework. And I wrote the music of that show and employed my friends who were musicians as well, who understood that type of music as well. And so Bluest Eye, I used nursery rhyme songs in an acoustic bluegrass style to take us through the four seasons of the play. And there was something about those nursery rhymes that hit home to the child in all of us, which really helped you identify with the main character. The style was very much of a blues and bluegrass. I also use piano too, so piano and acoustic instruments. And well, piano is an acoustic instrument, but acoustic guitar, string instruments, I mean. And although the piano I used for the more harsher moments, and I used the guitar for the softer moments, there were thematic things between which was the mother, which was the father, like depending on the family characters as well. And I was really, really nervous. I was very nervous about that one because I had to carry such weight of an emotional value of an experience I really would know nothing about. And I learned so much. I mean, in all those plays that I did that were diverse, I learned so much about different cultures. It really changed everything in my life. And I'm so grateful for them all. But Bluest Eye was the first big major one that did that. And it was such a great compliment for the cast to just be like, wow, you got it. Like, and when I got that validation from the cast, I was just like, oh my God, like all that work. But so valuable in life to do that. So that one was a beautiful experience. We ended up bringing it to New York too. We did it in Chicago for a while, and then we brought it to New York, and that was such a great experience.
So am I right that it was at the Steppenwolf,
It was at
Chicago?
Steppenwolf, and then Steppenwolf brought it to the Duke Theater in New York. I had a short run there too. But then something like A Christmas Carol, which is a ghost story. That is really playing upon how do you scare an audience, and whose perspective are you following in the play? Because there are different times when you're coming from Scrooge's perspective of what he's witnessing of his past, and how does that affect him emotionally? And you want to feel what Scrooge is feeling, so. At first, you may not be feeling anything until the end of the play. So there's a gradual arc as to how do you get an audience to emotionally feel for somebody towards the end of the play. And it all has to do with whose point of view are you taking it from? Are you objectively looking from an audience member to comment on Scrooge's reactions, or are you actually feeling what he's feeling? So there's the two different intentions of of whether or not you want them to empathize or sympathize. So empathize, actually feel it, or sympathize, be removed and watch and have a reaction to it. So that one was a play in that. And at the same time, it's a ghost story. And all those ghosts are different and they can be portrayed very different ways. And I've done it with different directors and different casts. And so I've had many different Christmas carols that I've had to do that take them all slightly in a different way that I then have to change and support what that new show is. So that one's an interesting one too.
I think that's brilliant, because I think one of the things that you realize in listening to the approach is that the sound in and of itself is very much intrinsic and intertwined, intrinsically linked to the story. And I think maybe plays an enormous part in committing people's emotional resonance of whether it be the character or the overall story. How is that different maybe in The God of Hell that you did at the Actor Studio?
Well, that one I was actually, that God of Hell, I was the associate designer on, but the God of Hell that was in Chicago was the one that I designed. So okay. I'll talk about the Chicago one, because that's really was my baby. That one is a Sam Shepard play, which I don't know if you know Sam Shepard, it's going to be out there in some way. And it's a de-evolution of a play into madness in a sense, that then gets more and more dissonant and weird and just really crazy by the end of it. That had to reflect the shift, and all I had were four transitions within the play. I mean, I had a lot of sound effects too, but the musical value of it, because there was no underscoring, because sometimes in theater, it doesn't make sense to underscore because life is not actually underscored. So if you're going for reality, you're not really going to have underscoring. Underscoring really is when you're going to heighten something out of reality in a sense, for an audience. So I only had these four transitions. So in order to do that, I started with what was Americana kind of music and then shifted it every single time to devolve into this kind of chaos towards the end. And by the end, I changed like time signatures. And as we're going, I worked with four different, four musicians who helped me along with this, because I wrote the original pieces. And I'm like, okay, so this time, this is what my intention is. This is what I want to do. I want to change that. So if we make this one a sharp and this one like, and we literally all kind of discussed where we would clash and where we wouldn't clash and how much we would do that. So it was really a group effort with all of us as musicians as to how that was going to devolve through the entire play. So every time you got to a transition and the set is changing into this weird thing and everybody's feeling really more uncomfortable and more uncomfortable as we go, the music was getting more uncomfortable as you went as well. So it just heightened everything into the next scene of like, oh my God. And it just kept going down and down and down and down, you know? So that was one of those where the arc is just a straight down arc that you have to follow.
What's the advice that you would give someone who's interested in theatrical sound design? What advice would you give them at the earliest time when they're just breaking in? What should they do? How do they get into it?
I have so many advice, so much advice. Like, to break it down into one thing, I would say not to compare yourself to others in any way, first of all. To do it as long as you're passionate as in doing it. And if you're getting joy out of the doing it, because there will be ups and downs in an artistic career, especially in theater. And they tend to clump together weirdly, like they have in a couple my life and a couple of my friends' lives, where the downs will be like a few shows in a row and then the ups will be a few shows in a row. Sometimes it's so sporadic that even in those down moments, remember why you really like doing it or why you really have chosen this. To make it more of a lasting career. So I think that's the thing of like, in order to last through it, you have to not compare, really want to do it, be passionate and to get through the down parts of it in order to, and remember the high parts of it, especially because I mean, that's how we qualify, right? We
Yeah.
qualify with the goods by the bad and the bad by the good. So when you're in that bad, like, remember that good stuff.
That's wonderful advice. Toy, thank you for not only humbly breaking barriers in theatrical sound design, but taking us on an innovative journey of where sound meets human health. It is through artists like you that we truly understand the potency of creativity. Toy, you embody the very spirit of creativity. And it reminds me that art and design is not only provocative, but ever-evolving. So as we close this inspirational chapter of Design By Dot Show, I urge all of you to not only listen, but to hear. Hear the world around you, just as Toy does in her work. Thank you once again to the ingenious Toy Diario for sharing her magical world with us. And thank you to our loyal listeners. So I do want to remind you that as we sign off today, there's an important thing that we have to do when we are taunting the tomorrow that we all want. We must dare to design a better future for everyone, everywhere, every single day. Design By Dot Show is created and written by The Design Corps. Original score, audio, and sound design by Rachel Bickley. Podcast production by Substance Studios at Aurora 21 in the heart of New York's Hudson Valley. And I'm your host, Joanna Pena Bickley.
Substance Studios.